You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Musa.
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
Can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Musa Al-Gharbi, a sociologist and a professor of communication and journalism at Stony Brook University, and the author of We Have Never Been Woke, published by Princeton University Press pretty recently. Four or five months ago?
October 8th, whenever that was.
Let me do the math. Yeah. I'll call that a few months. We're going to talk about the book. First, we're going to talk about a related matter, which is Donald Trump. I'm going to try to get you to give some tactical and maybe even strategic guidance to opponents of Trump. At a minimum, tell them some mistakes that maybe you should avoid that some of them made last time around. I should say, by way of establishing your credentials here, you were one of the very few people emphasizing in the run-up to the 2016 election that Trump actually had a good chance of winning. Not many people were saying that at all, certainly not going on record the way you were. And you and I had a podcast conversation a year or two into the Trump administration that was called Why Trump Won and Could Win Again. So I guess you're two for two. I think you had in mind the 2020 election as the most likely time he would win, but actually he almost did win that. And in any event, he did win again. You can pretty much start where you want. Maybe a place to start is to ask. And I think, by the way, this will just naturally segue into your book kind of organically as we proceed. What mistakes did the resistance make, the so-called resistance make, last time around?
Yeah. So I think to get a handle on that question, one of the things that's important to recognize is how Trump won both this time and last, like which constituencies have been shifting over time. On my Substack, I have an essay called A Graveyard of Bad Election Narratives. I've written versions of this essay three times now, one after each of the last presidential elections. And one of the things the main thing that I show in that essay is that a lot of the narratives that progressives and liberals and Democrats like to tell about why Trump won, they're just empirically dubious. They're not well substantiated by the best evidence we have about how people voted and why. So, for instance, if you look along the lines of race, the reason Trump was able to pull off a victory in 2024 was largely because of shifts among non-white voters. So, since 2010, basically, the GOP has been seeing pretty consistent gains with African Americans, with Hispanics, with Asian Americans. And even as they've been actually seeing weakness in many cases, sometimes attrition in 2020, for instance, Joe Biden was able to win largely because of shifts in white voters, especially white men. Mm-hmm. So even as they've been seeing some weakness with whites, the Republicans, they've been seeing consistent gains with non-white voters. In terms of gender, Kamala Harris got the lowest level of support of any Democratic candidate of the last 30 years since there was this gender divide opened up in politics. Harris got the lowest vote share of women of any candidate over the last 30 years, other than John Kerry, who incidentally was the first candidate I voted for,
you're young, by my standards.
So Harris did really poorly with women. It's not, including and especially non-white women and young women. So it's not the case. Harris didn't do especially poorly with men. She got about the same vote share with men that Democrats usually win. The reason she lost was because she was very weak with women compared to most other Democratic nominees. In terms of class, There's a lot of talk about how Trump and Musk and all those rich people who were there with this inauguration, that this is some kind of oligarchy. And but when you actually look at the way people voted along class lines, in this cycle, and actually, again, in pretty much every election over the last 10 years, Democrats have been doing consistently worse with working class voters, with less affluent voters, with less educated voters, even as they've been doing better and better with affluent voters, including the super rich and the millionaires and the billionaires.
Now, just a point of clarification, it is possible for Trump to have a largely middle lower class constituency and still have an oligarchy, right?
I mean, sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, then this is often how these things work out in the first place. You have like these kinds of powerful, well-connected oligarchs that have a strong populist base. So that's a kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's not an unusual arrangement, but it's also the case that if you look at who was supporting the Democrats, they've been growing increasingly wealthy. All the wealthiest communities in the U.S. went for the Democrats. Affluent voters, people who make 100,000 years or more, for instance, went for the Democrats. Kamala Harris had more millionaires and billionaires supporting her than Trump. She outraised Trump 2-1. The Democrats have raised twice as much dark money over the last couple of elections. So, you know, the if you want to look at the, you know, where the money ended up going in the race, the money was behind the Democrats and they lost.
You know, it's funny. I think some people use the term oligarchy casually. I use it very intentionally because I make a distinction, I mean, as the dictionary does, between plutocracy and oligarchy. So plutocracy is kind of when the rich are disproportionately influential. Oligarchy is something a little more, you know, a small number of super rich people who have huge influence, and they may have forms of power that matter to the, you know, to the president in this case and so on. So what I would say is we've been becoming more and more plutocratic for some time. And this is the first time I have been willing to think about using the term oligarchy somewhat literally.
And again, I don't think that the trends that we've seen in terms of socioeconomic affiliation, as you put it, well, are inconsistent with understanding this administration as an oligarchy. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also important to like keep two thoughts in the mind at once. One, this administration might have strong oligarchic tendencies or be well described as an oligarchy. But it's also the case that if you look at who the rich, the powerful, the educated, the privileged, the affluent are supporting on average, they're much more likely to lean Democrat, and they've been trending even more that way over the last decade in a pretty consistent pattern. And so this is something that a lot of Democrats and progressives have not really reckoned with well or thought much about what that entails for the party and its priorities and its platforms and its messaging and so on. But it's actually really important. The fact that these kind of affluent, highly educated, urban and suburban voters are now the core constituency of the Democratic Party matters a lot for the kinds of candidates they put forward, for the kinds of messaging that they rely on, for the things they focus on or not in their platforms and so forth. And so this is one of the things that actually has been driving the disaffection that a lot of voters have had with the Democratic Party is precisely because the party has become really heavily oriented around trying to reflect the preferences, priorities, and values of this kind of highly educated, affluent, urban and suburban professionals.
Right, which is a good example of something that kind of leads naturally to your book, but we won't go there quite yet. The just kind of incidentally, today I listened to the beginning of our podcast conversation from whatever it was 7 years ago, and it's interesting. You know, this election, after this Trump victory, there was all this talk about, oh my God, he's winning. You know, he did well among Blacks and Latinos, as if it was news. But you, in that conversation, were emphasizing that's what had happened that time, and not many people were emphasizing it. In fact, the first part of our conversation was devoted to a critique of kind of the coalescing conventional wisdom as reflected in op-ed pieces and academic papers, and so on. And so you were emphasizing the movement, this demographic drift toward Trump that got more attention this time around.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was the, yeah. So these trends have been actually visible since 2010, but they have not really been processed in previous cycles. So again, in 2016, the reason mm-hmm. Trump won was also because of shifts among, say, non-whites as compared to whites. In 2020, the reason Biden won, as I illustrated in the Guardian after the election, was exclusively actually because of shifts among whites and men. Democrats did worse in 2020 with women, with non-whites, with non-white women. It was whites, men, especially white men, who helped push Biden over the line. And this is another thing that no one really talked about because it doesn't really fit the narrative about why people vote for Trump or about why people vote for Democrats, for that matter.
Right. When we think of the classic Trump voter, we think of a white guy in a pickup truck, I guess.
Can I add real quick?
Yeah.
You also had a good prediction that last conversation that we had, you talked about how you thought Biden could have beat Trump, and then Biden did go and beat Trump in the next cycle.
Yeah. I think he would have done better the first time around. He was a little sharper, and but who knows? Actually, Trump in a way had more baggage the second time around after January 6th. But I've always thought. This time around, I was urging Biden to drop out like 2 years ago, but that was on grounds of age. He was in principle always a strong, I thought, anti-Trump candidate. So, by the way, there's one thing I said in our last conversation that I want to put a finer point on now because I realized I failed to. I said, you were saying everyone is paying attention to like the white working class vote, but that's not what made the difference. Trump got in that realm about what Republicans get, maybe if not less, I don't know, but not, that wasn't the key. It was these other demographics that pushed him over the top. And I said, yeah, but the white vote is so interesting because Trump is so different from past Republican candidates. So it's kind of interesting that they stuck with him. So I guess the way I'd put it now is you're right that the white vote isn't that, especially this part of the white vote, kind of white working class, isn't that relevant to why Trump won the general election. It is of interest if you ask why he won the primary, why he was the nominee in the first place, right? I mean, do you agree like that's, because if they hadn't nominated him, he wouldn't have won the general election. Does that make any sense?
I think that's true in 2016. Like even if we just roll it back to the first election, so mm-hmm. Trump won that election with the lowest vote share of any successful candidate. So like he got the lowest vote share of the total Republican vote of anyone who won the Republican nomination in modern history. And this was, so he didn't have this kind of rabid, he wasn't like hugely popular in 2016 at the time he won the nomination. He won the nomination in part because he had this base of people who were really supporting him. And there was like 18 other candidates.
Right.
The anti-Trump alternative was divided between several candidates. And he had this really strong movement behind him that was not the majority or even particularly close, but was bigger than anyone else. And so he was able to win.
And there the white working class did matter, right?
Yeah. And so this is, my point is, so in that cycle, kind of white working class voters were some of the, was mm-hmm. like one of those blocks of the Republican base that was really more strongly and uniquely behind Trump. And that was key to him being able to have this base of support so that even if most Republicans in that cycle didn't want Trump to be the nominee, he was still able to come out on top because everyone else was divided between multiple candidates.
Yeah. I guess one reason I ask is because one thing I was saying, my newsletter, Non-Zero Newsletter, started out as the Mindful Resistance newsletter shortly into the first Trump era because I thought the resistance was just like too reactive and too freaked out and they needed to be more deliberate and careful. And one thing I said was like, if you talk as if this is all motivated by racism, you know, you just, that's not going to get them to vote for you next time. and I was thinking largely about the white working class, but, you certainly don't want to, I guess, arouse that part of the base if you want to ultimately vanquish Trump. But I guess you would say, would you say that that advice isn't really so to the point? What demographic should the resistance focus on trying to persuade or undermine their enthusiasm for Trump or whatever?
I think they should focus on the working class, but understood in a less identitarian way. Mm-hmm. So there's this great study by Jacobin and YouGov called Common Sense Solidarity. And one of the things that they find in this study is that, like, there's this presumption in a lot of circles that working class people, especially white working class people, hate LGBTQ people and minorities and all of this kind of stuff. What they find is that's not the case. The thing about it is working class people just have different priorities in terms of messaging, in terms of the ways policies are structured, in terms of the way messaging is structured. So some examples that they give are that affluent professional type people really like policies that are targeted towards particular identity groups, and they really like messaging that emphasizes racism, sexism, celebrating differences, celebrating identity, and so on. Working class people is basically the opposite. What they really prize, what really resonates well with them, is things that emphasize shared values, common goals, superordinate identities. So, you know, you're black, I'm white, we're both Americans or Christians or whatever. So superordinate identities, things like this. And they like policies that are more universalistic in their structure. So for a lot of, for instance, when you look at a lot of affirmative action policies that are targeted on the basis of, say, race, for a lot of working class constituents, and this is true across racial and ethnic lines, for a lot of working class constituents, race-targeted affirmative action programs, they view them as unfair. Because if the goal is to help people who are struggling and poor and trying to get by, if you only help people who are struggling and poor and trying to get by, if they happen to be Black or Hispanic, for instance, then that's the same as denying other people who are struggling, denying them help because they're white. That's the same as like targeting other people who are poor and desperate and punishing them on the basis of their race. Or excluding them on the basis of their race. So a lot of working class people view a policy like that as racist or improper. And so what would be, if the goal is to help people who are desperate and struggling, then the priority should be to target people on the basis of class. And the upside of that is that to the extent that, say, Black and Hispanic people are disproportionately likely to be working class or poor, if you design a policy that's designed to help working class and poor people, Black and Hispanic people will disproportionately benefit from that. But you also won't see the same resistance from working class people across racial lines, because that kind of a program strikes people as more fair. So working class people tend to like universalistically oriented policies. They don't like things that are focused on particular subsets of isolating particular subsets of people for what they perceive to be special treatment.
But when you say universalistic, how universal does universalistic have to be? In other words, is class an example of a superordinate identity that these people are willing to associate with? Working class, for example, like we're all working class. Let's struggle to get our due.
Working class, middle class, these kinds of class, things that can speak to a broad range of constituencies that live in different, especially if you draw a distinction between working class or middle class people and rich, powerful, affluent people who are you know, exploiting the system, getting more than their fair share, not contributing as much as they should be, and so on. That kind of populist messaging can actually be very effective. The problem is... again, that the Democratic Party is themselves, like the core constituency of the Democratic Party is increasingly those people who would be villainized in populist messaging, people who are in the top quintile of income, people who are highly educated, who are well-connected, who live in these major cities. And so this is one of the challenges that we face in terms of messaging. But like, if you want to know what a good path forward, a policy path.
Well, this is a virtue of the Sanders approach, which is just to call them billionaires. His version of, you know, kind of rhetorical populism. And it's a virtue of the word oligarch, I guess. I mean, I'm talking about for instrumental political uses. But so basically, you're saying that a class-based left will be more effective than an identity-based left. And when you talk about superordinate identity, you mainly mean kind of trans-ethnic. It doesn't have to be completely universal, but you don't think the emphasis on ethnically identity kind of politics works.
Yeah, I mean, well, so like, or you could even like religion is another example. It's a real big missed opportunity that the left is often uncomfortable talking about religion because most people in America subscribe to a faith tradition. If you think it's too parochial to focus on Christianity, you can talk about people of faith. People of faith this, people of faith that, as people of faith, as people who are, you know, so this is another example of a type of superordinate identity that is important to people that crosses a lot of lines in terms of geography, class, race, and so on, that can be powerful and persuasive. And the Republicans are pretty good at that in the sense that if you actually look at the Republican base, Republicans have been gaining with religious people across the board. So not just Christians, Catholics, or Protestants, but also Jewish people, Muslims, Hindus. Like, if actually a lot of the prominent people running in the Republican side now are Hindus, like Nikki Haley, Vivek Ramaswamy, and so on.
I think, is Nikki Haley, well, she's of Hindu background. I think she's, I thought she was Catholic now.
But there are Patel, who's about to run the FBI. I'm pretty sure he's Hindu, if I recall correctly. But but even Muslims. So before October, you know, even before October 7th, as I showed in an essay in the 2020 election, Trump, the Republican Party, made huge gains with Muslims. They've been making consistent gains with, and so it's religious people across the board that the Republicans. Yeah. So they've been able to talk about faith and the importance of faith and values and all of this kind of stuff in a superordinate way that wasn't just focused on Christians and alienating anyone who wasn't Christians. Instead, they've been able to actually kind of build a big tent around people of faith in a way that Democrats could as well. Most faith traditions call for people to look out for the most vulnerable among us. Most faith traditions, in fact, do have norms and policies and rules that are designed to check the wealthy and the powerful and people who are creating chaos and destruction and harm in the world and so on and so forth. And so there are ways that we can talk about left progressive goals within the framework of religion, but a lot of us have an allergy to this in a way that undermines our ability to reach a lot of constituents.
Yeah, can I file a minor complaint about whoever organized Jimmy Carter's funeral? I thought this was weird. They played John Lennon's Imagine. Nice song. But it has this line, you know, Imagine, blah, 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 and no religion, too. Well, Jimmy Carter was a deeply religious man, A. Yeah. And B, I don't think the left, is kind of resonates with what you're saying, should be associated with the idea that world peace can only come when everyone's an atheist or something because religion is the source of conflict. I think that's not... That's like a neocon or almost right-wing diagnosis. To think, for example, that the Israel-Palestine conflict is about religion, right? It's like the problem is they're Muslims. Well, no, it's a fight over land that originally was described as a fight between Arabs and Jews, and Arab Christians were as upset about the whole thing as Arab Muslims. And it's just to me, I mean, the left-wing diagnosis is that material conditions are well, formative generally in terms of social structure, but are the source of conflict and war. And I think that's right. And it just I don't know. I think that's pretty weird, honestly.
Like, yeah, it's a big missed opportunity, and it is weird. It's weird for a bunch of reasons. One, because as you said, not only was Jimmy Carter a man of faith, but his Christian faith is what inspired him to pursue a lot of the progressive social reforms that he did, and a lot of the activists and activism that he did after he got out of the presidency, building houses for poor people and stuff with his own hands and stuff like this. And
you know, it's funny. One thing he said was that at Camp David, he had a stronger bond with Anwar Sadat because he was such a devoutly religious man. Of course, they were all Abrahamics. Menachem Begin was the third. But Carter really felt that resonance. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the things that I think is underappreciated about Carter is that he was actually responsible for helping mobilize religious voters back into the public sphere. So especially after the world wars and stuff, a lot of evangelicals resigned themselves from politics. They thought the world was kind of fallen and hopeless, that U.S. politics was. You know, Carter had this really inspirational message. He leveraged the social gospel, a lot of other things like this. He helped mobilize the evangelical base in a way that they hadn't been fully mobilized in previous years. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to hold that base. Reagan took a lot of those voters from him. But the fact that there's, but still Carter's win and his candidacy and the basis he was able to mobilize show that there's a path for Democrats and progressives and left-leaning people to evoke and engage with religion in a way that is politically efficacious, to just seed this. To cede religion and faith and the associated values and commitments completely to the GOP is wild, given that the overwhelming majority of people in America associate with one of these faith traditions. It's just a mistake. It's like an obvious mistake.
So you would say, class-based left is going to have a better chance against the whole Trumpist phenomenon than identity politics. There is a class-based left still visible. I mean, some of the, Glenn Greenwald is in a way, he's an example of someone who is critical of identity politics and old-fashioned class-based left. Of course, he is, some people find him a bit on the abrasive side. I'm sure there are other examples. I want to turn to your book. Is there anything else before we do that you would say about strategy this time? I mean, I think the policy strategy you're recommending is, let's actually drill down on that a little more. I mean, first of all, I assume you're saying that, for example, if you provide better health insurance for middle, lower income Americans, that transcends ethnicity, it's class-based. If the Democrats were identified with that and the Republicans weren't, that would be a Democratic asset. But are you also saying that just rhetorically, the focus, the let's call it wokeness for short, but the focus on identity politics is a rhetorical liability because it drives people on the other side crazy? Because I might think you wouldn't say that because maybe I'm wrong, though. Maybe it does drive people of color crazy as well as white voters. I mean, I was going to say, if you don't emphasize the white vote so much, how big a liability could the wokeness be? But why don't you straighten me out?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the big problems, is that the a lot of the claims that are made on behalf of racial and ethnic minorities are actually alienating to the people it's supposed to appeal to. So for instance, with respect to, say, criminal justice reform, so a lot of people insist about talking about criminal justice reform in these very racialized ways, and they insist on taking these kinds of moving more towards in the loose direction of, like, abolishing the police, abolishing prisons, things like this. The problem with this kind of thing is that actually African Americans are some of the biggest victims of crime. And a lot of Black people and Hispanic people and so on have real concerns about public safety and public order. And so when they hear abolish the police, that's just not something, or it's, reduce the police. Like if you look at polling and surveys, the most Black people in America actually want the same level or more policing in there. Like a lot of communities are over-policed and badly policed. But some of them are simultaneously under-policed. Like African-Americans on average want better policing.
Right.
But they don't want necessarily less policing. And the same with abolishing prisons. The vast majority of people who are in prison in the United States, according to the Prison Policy Institute, who released this great graph called The Whole Pie that shows you everyone in federal, state, and local prisons and what they're there for. The majority of people who are in prison in the United States are there for violent offenses, rapes, murders, mm-hmm. assaults. And even the ones who aren't there for violent offenses are there for, not like having a small amount of pot or something like that, but doing things like trafficking drugs in a way that ravage communities and things like this. And so mm-hmm. when Black voters hear things like, well, let's close the prisons, the question is, okay, well, where are those people going to go? They're not going to be going to the Upper West Side of Manhattan into places with a bunch of white liberals. They're going to be coming into my community, causing problems. And I've got problems already, right? And so people, like a lot of us, when we talk about abolishing prisons, we just assume it's a bunch of nonviolent offenders who are in prison and we just let them out and they reintegrate easily with the community. There's a great study by a sociologist, Matt Desmond, called Beyond the Easiest Cases that really emphasizes this point. If we want to move people on abolition, we have to speak to their concerns, to their real and actual concerns. And the concerns that a lot of people have when they hear things about prison abolition is, what are we going to do with violent offenders? And it's a good concern mm-hmm. because, again, they are the majority of people who are behind bars. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us, we don't even speak to that. And Hispanics, likewise, if you look at immigration policy, some of the people who are most in favor of immigration restrictions are Hispanics. Or if you look at things like LGBTQ issues and so on, who in the Democratic coalition is most skeptical of providing gender affirming care to minors or teaching about sexuality aggressively in K-12 schools and so on? Well, that would be Black people, Hispanic people, religious minorities, and so on, much more than the privileged people, highly educated, relatively affluent people, white people, and so on. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these identitarian things actually alienate the non-privileged people that they're supposed to be appealing to. So that's one of the problems with the focus on identity. Another problem with it is that it sends a signal that reinforces the perception that a lot of people already have, that the Democratic Party is more focused on symbols than substance, that we're focused on, this, like, winning these cosmic and symbolic struggles over addressing ordinary people's problems. And the irony is, if you look at the policy accomplishments of Joe Biden, he actually did pass a lot of laws and policies that were useful and aimed at working class people and that were kind of mm-hmm. class oriented. He didn't get credit for them for two reasons. First, because his administration also was very aggressive about pushing a lot of identitarian stuff, a bunch of stuff about sex and race and all of this kind of stuff that sucked the oxygen out of the room for those policy accomplishments. And then second, Biden was really risk-averse and averse to engaging with the press. So he actually held the smallest number of interviews and press briefings of any president in modern history. And this was true during the campaign trail. This was true as president. And Kamala Harris did much the same, actually. She did not do many interviews, whereas Donald Trump is happy mm-hmm. to talk to whoever you want. You put a camera in front of him. This wasn't the case with Biden and Harris. And so even the laws that they, even the good work that they did do, they didn't get credit for because they refused to just go talk to people and tell people what they did. And so, but So if you had a more populist-oriented, like more narrowly focused on addressing the ordinary problems of working people, and an administration that was more committed to touting the ordinary things they did for working people. I mean, Donald Trump, when he passed these stimulus checks, he made sure that his personal signature was in big-ass letters on each one of those checks. People got the checks. They saw the check was from Donald Trump, right? Like, Democrats are much worse about, you know, managing the optics of this so that people understand the good things that did happen, and so that Democrats get credit for the good things that did happen.
I mean, both Biden and Harris, I think, had reasons to be camera shy, maybe, but it didn't help. So let's talk about your book. I see it on the shelf behind you. Why don't you hold it up in front of the camera? It's got an interesting jacket. Whoa, that's we should do a seizure warning. I mean, that's got like that's cool. I mean, Princeton University Press went all out for that. That's like special effects. So we have never been woke. Yeah. And why don't you tell us what kind of the thesis is?
Yeah. So the big question that the book is trying to ask is this. So starting in the period after World War One, in between World War One and World War Two, the interwar period, and then especially accelerating after the 60s, there were these big changes to the global economy that favored the knowledge professions. So people who work in fields like finance and consulting and HR and education and media, and so where we're manipulating symbols and data and information instead of providing physical goods and services to people. One of the things that's interesting about a lot of these professions is that from the time they were created, they were we've had more pay than most people, more autonomy than most people, more prestige than most other workers. And we've said the reason that you should give us these things, the reason why we is not for our own sake, but because if you give us these things, we'll use these resources to the benefit of everyone in society, including and especially the least among us. And so professions like journalism are explicitly defined in terms of altruism and the common good. We're supposed to speak truth to power and be a voice for the voiceless and take, you know, specialized and complicated things and give them to people in a concise and accessible way so that they can be full and active participants in democracy. Or professors are supposed to follow the truth wherever it leads and to speak the truth without concern to anyone's political and economic interests, so on and so forth. Lawyers, and so on.
One way people put the mission of journalism is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
Absolutely. and so what you might expect, and then if you look at in the contemporary context, at who in America is most likely to self-identify as an environmentalist, as a feminist, as an anti-racist, as an ally to LGBTQ people, or as someone who is themselves LGBTQ, as an ally to disabled people or to self-identify as disabled, and so on. It's people who work in the knowledge professions. We're the ones who are most likely to identify this way. And so what you might expect is that as more power and resources have been consolidated in our hands, and as we've grown more influential and affluent, that you might expect to see a lot of longstanding social problems getting fixed. You might expect to see inequality shrinking. You might expect to see growing trust in institutions because of all the great work that we're doing, and so on and so forth. Instead, over the last 50 years, we've seen the opposite. We've seen growing institutional mistrust and dysfunction, growing polarization. We've seen rising inequalities and things like this. And so the key question the book is trying to ask is basically, what's going on here? Why do we see the world we actually live in instead of the world that we promised or might have hoped for or expected as people like us got more power and influence? And so that's the core question that the book is.
So why has the professional class failed to deliver on their end of the deal, kind of?
Yeah, we got the things that we asked for. We do have we said we want more power, more wealth, more influence over policymaking. We got all of that in a way that's dramatic.
Speak for yourself, but congratulations. Many of us tried, and I'm happy for the ones who succeeded. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, well, no, but yeah. So even compared to the average worker or the average American, to the modal American, the differences between us and everyone else have grown increasingly dramatic in terms of the lifestyles that we lead compared to other people, the pay that we have compared to other people, the autonomy and job security and prestige that we have compared to other people. It's astonishing. The gap between us and everyone else along all of these dimensions and others has just grown in terms of health and life expectancy and things like that. Vast and growing difference between us and everyone else. And so the book is trying to figure out basically why is it that things look so different than what we promised. The core answer, the nutshell answer to that, is that it's not that knowledge economy professionals are cynical or insincere. So that's not the answer to the question. So it's when we say things like we want the poor to be uplifted, or we want the people at the margins of society to live lives of dignity and inclusion, we're not lying. This isn't a, you know. But the problem is our commitments to egalitarianism isn't our only set of sincere commitments. We're also sincerely committed to being elites, which is to say, we think that our perspectives and our voice and our opinions should carry more weight than the person checking us out at the grocery store. We think we should enjoy a higher standard of living than the people delivering our packages. And we want our children to have the same standard of living up as us, or an even better one. These two commitments, the commitment to be an elite, the commitment to be an egalitarian, they're in fundamental tension. You can't really be an egalitarian social climber. It's a contradiction in terms. And so when these two drives come into conflict, as they often do, the argument I make is that it's often the drive to be an elite that ends up winning out and transforming how we pursue social justice. So we end up trying to pursue it mostly in ways that don't require us to risk anything or give up anything or change anything about our own lifestyles, our own opportunities, our own commitments, and so on. Mostly our dream is to try to make all of our social justice goals happen by appropriating things from other people, especially the 1%. This is, if we just tax Elon Musk enough, we can solve all the world's problems. And as I argue in the book,
actually, given how much money he has, we might be able to if there was a wealth tax. I'm kidding, but go ahead.
Well, I think there should be a wealth. So here's the thing: I think there should be a wealth tax. I think that we, in fact, I think there are a whole bunch of other things that we could maybe change, should change about society to render the economy more dynamic, to help the to increase the to decrease the power and influence over the wealthy and so on. But that said, one of the problems with this narrative we tell about how the 1% are responsible for all of the social problems in the world, well, there's a couple problems. One of them is that even when you look at wealth distribution, so the top 1% in the United States control 27% of America's wealth. Now, that's a radically disproportionate share. 1% control 27%. Mm-hmm. But notice, 27% isn't a majority of America's wealth. It's not even anywhere close to a majority. Now, what happens if you zoom out to the top 20%? So you include the millionaires and the billionaires, but also the upper middle class. Well, then you can account for 72% of America's wealth. Another way of saying that is 80% of Americans, 4 out of 5 Americans, make do with only 28% of the country's wealth. When you zoom out, when you pay attention to this point, 1% controls 27%. The rest of the 20% control the rest of the 72%. It's actually the case that quintiles 2 through 20, I mean, that percentiles 2 through 20 of the wealth distribution control not quite, but almost twice as much wealth as the top 1%. And so if we just focus on the top 1%, we're missing the lion's share of the wealth, or missing the lion's share of the wealth among the relatively affluent in society, for that matter. The upper middle class controls almost twice as much wealth as the top 1%. And so when we exclude ourselves from analysis, it's very convenient for us. It allows, when we say the 1%, and we're just the 99%. And the only problem is the million. We're just ordinary Joes in the same boat with the, you know, that's a very convenient narrative for us to tell that it's false. And another big problem with the focus on looking at just the corporations and the millionaires and the billionaires and so on, as I show in the book in chapter 3, almost anything that we don't like about the way things happen in society, it actually happens pretty much with us and through us. Anything that the millionaires and the billionaires accomplish, they accomplish with and through knowledge economy professionals, and they couldn't accomplish it without us. And the same thing with multinational corporations and so on. I'll give one quick example. Anand Giridharadas wrote a great book called Winners Take All. It's probably around this. And it's about how millionaires.
I had him on the podcast, talking about that years ago.
Yeah, it's a great book. So it focuses on how millionaires and billionaires use big philanthropy to paint themselves as the solutions to problems that they themselves created. So they and their corporations, through the myopic pursuit of maximizing wealth, create all this social havoc, and then they donate a bunch of money and create all these nonprofits, and they go, oh, I'm the hero, I'm the good guy, I'm the solution to all of these. Okay, so it's a great book. People should buy it. Buy mine first. But when you kind of step back for a second and look at this mystification process that Anand describes, well, how does it happen? Who is it that works in the PR firms?
What is the mystification process?
So mystification is when you convince people, so an example of mystification would be the millionaires and the billionaires convincing everyone that they're the ones who are solving the social problems when they're in fact creating them. So it's when you obscure how and why things actually happen and tell people and convince people of a false story that's more convenient for your interests. So when you look at how does that actually happen? Well, who is it that works in the PR firms that, you know, help them launder their reputations, after they give these donations? Well, that would be knowledge economy professionals, symbolic capitalists, as I call them. Oh, well, who is it that writes these glowing media, that gives them this glowing media coverage after these donations and applies insufficient scrutiny to the harm that they cause? Oh, well, that would be journalists. Well, they're symbolic capitalists too. Oh, okay. Well, who is it that administers these nonprofits through which they launder their money and reputations? Oh, that would be us, the symbolic capitalists. Oh, well, who is it that works in the financial firms that help them avoid taxes and do all this kind of money laundering stuff? Oh, that would be us too. Almost every single part of that process of the things that the millionaires and the millionaires do, they do with us and through us, and they couldn't do it without us. And so if we only focus on the millionaires and the billionaires, we're actually missing how and why a lot of stuff actually happens in the world. And the last thing I'll note about the problem with just taxing Elon Musk enough is that it's actually tough to just take money from the people who have a lot of money and give it to people who need money. I mean, it's more possible now through platforms that allow people to do like microfinance, give directly and things like that. So you can just transfer money directly to people who need it. Okay. Uh-huh. But that's actually kind of hard. It's hard to just take money from Elon Musk and give it to people who need it. What happens instead is money gets taken from Elon Musk, from the millionaires and the billionaires and the rich and whatever. It gets put into institutions that symbolic capitalists tend to control. And we tend to gobble up most of it. And then whatever, after we've had our fill, we kind of let the crumbs fall to everyone else. That's usually what happens. I'll give one quick example of this. As I talk about in chapter 2 of the book, when the symbolic professions are being formed, two big things happen. There was the passage of the income tax, which was defended in the Supreme Court. And it allowed the U.S. government to tax the Gilded Age elites in a way that they couldn't before. And then there was the creation of big philanthropy in its recognizably modern form. You started seeing all of these nonprofits and so on crop up. Mm-hmm. As a result of these two things, there was this massive transfer of wealth from the Gilded Age elites downward. Sounds great. Okay, but where did the money go? As Randall Collins and other sociologists shows in his book, The Credential Society, The main wealth transfer that actually occurred during this period was from the rich to the upper middle class. Knowledge economy professionals took from the rich and we gave to ourselves. Now, there was a lot of, there were some programs that were created. There were a lot of, there was a lot, there was some wealth and like common people did benefit, but like not nearly as much as they could have or that one might have expected, given the sheer amount of resources that were transferred downwards at that time. And this is a tendency that wasn't just a thing that was like a one-off during this period. It's a pattern that repeats when we have big transfers of wealth downwards. It usually ends up in our hands. We gobble up what we want and then kick some other stuff down to other people. And maybe they benefit a little bit, but not as much as you might expect. And so in many cases, inequalities grow because the people in the who are the upper middle class professionals and so on actually become richer than ever. And even if other people also become marginally better off than they were, in relation to the upper middle class and the rich, the inequalities actually grow. And this is a pattern that repeats over time. So this is these are kind of three reasons why, even if we should tax Elon Musk more, we shouldn't imagine that that's going to solve all the world's problems, because we're a big part of the problem. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to keep talking about your book. As you know, we divide the podcast into the public part, which is drawing to a close, and the overtime, which is available to non-zero members, that is paid subscribers of the non-zero newsletter, and you can become one by going to the newsletter. And then you can set up a podcast feed that will always give you the overtime segments and also a lot of other bonus content in print. When we continue the discussion of your book at overtime, I want to tie in the whole woke thing, drill down more on the title, and how you get the status competition among these elites for the title of most woke, and why apparently, in your view, this kind of thing it kind of comes and goes. I mean, you've got this little cycles of history kind of theory involving the elite overproduction that's fascinating. And I want to get into all of that. Before we go into overtime, is there anything just in quick summary that you want to say about, aside from buy my book? I'll say that part, buy his book. And you don't have to say that.
I think one of the things that's just a thing to leave people with is that one of the big drivers of the what we saw in 2024 was that the people like us who work in the knowledge professions, we think and talk about politics and morality in ways that are just very different from most other people. And over the last 10 years, those differences have grown because we've changed a lot. Other people have changed less, and people have cared about those differences more, and they care about them more largely because of how we conducted ourselves, mocking, censoring, denigrating, humiliating anyone who disagreed with us, even for beliefs that we ourselves only adopted 10 minutes ago. And so the gap, people noticed the gap more, they cared about the gap more. And this is a big part of what gives an opportunity to political entrepreneurs like Trump and Ron DeSantis and all of these kinds of people. If we want to make progress on restoring people's trust in our institutions and people like us, in the Democratic Party, and so on and so forth, then we really need to work more at engaging with the values, priorities, preferences, concerns, and so on of ordinary people in a non-sneering, condescending, mocking, judgmental, or hostile way. This is like the core challenge that I think professionals, our institutions like higher ed and the media, and also, for that matter, the Democratic Party face over the next 4 years. It's kind of rebooting our relationship to a lot of the rest of the public.
Okay. I've got a feeling we're going to be talking about social media. In fact, I guarantee it. As soon as we get into overtime, I'm going to have a question related to that and that also relates to what you just said. But anyway, thanks to everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll join us in overtime. But even if not, we appreciate your listening.